Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Aparna Gopalan, and today I had the pleasure of speaking with Professor Walter Johnson about his indispensable new book, The Broken Heart of America, St. Louis and the Violent History of the United States. Here's the interview, and I hope you enjoy it.
Professor Johnson, welcome to the program. We're so glad to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let me just start by asking about what led you to become a historian of race and racism in America and how your relationship to history has changed over the course of your career.
It's been so long. There's obviously a whole layered set of answers to that. I think that probably the most pertinent one comes from my first year in graduate school. I had gone to graduate school to study political thought in early America, Republican political thought, small r Republican political thought, which is something I still think is completely fascinating. But I was taught, I took a class from Neller and Painter, who had just arrived at Princeton when I started my PhD. And I really became convinced by her that if I wasn't studying what I've come to call the history of racial capitalism, I wasn't studying American history. And so, there was probably a way that I could have done that. I'm certain there's a way I could have done that through the history of Republican political thought. But the way that I ended up doing it was under her direction and studying the slave market in New Orleans. That was the topic of my dissertation. And it's just kind of gone from there. The second part of the question was, how has my relationship to history changed? Is that?
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm a little bit more, it sounds strange to say, but I think I'm probably a little bit more interested in history than I was when I started out. I was not a conventional historian, I don't think. I think I was I was a little bit of an outlier. I wasn't particularly concerned with change over time, which a lot of historians will think is the hallmark of the discipline. And so the first book I wrote was really, I think, more influenced by what I think of as a kind of an anthropological approach. It had certain sorts of literary, I guess, even modernist literary overtones. It was very, very focused with people's self-understanding of events and with different perspectives, and was concerned with using different perspectives on a single event to problematize the notion that the event could be understood from any kind of one single orthodox position. And I think that position, that idea, that inclination on my part has stayed with me in a kind of a suspicion of many of the orthodox categories of interpretation. But at the same time, I think I have become more interested in stories about change over time, stories about political economy, stories about political organizing. And I think that both my second book and this book that I've just finished show that. I think I've become, in some ways, more influenced by Marxism, and in some ways more critical of it. I think I've learned a lot about what I would call the Black radical tradition, and that's now the kind of intellectual ground of my work.
Great, thank you for that. Also, what brought you to this particular project to St. Louis? And you start to go into it in the preface of the book a little bit,
yeah,
talking about how you came to it as more of a citizen than a historian. What does that mean?
Yeah, that actually, I have a very specific answer for that, which is that I had been invited sometime in the fall of 2013 to give an address at Washington University, and that was scheduled for October of 2014. And it was supposed to be a keynote address at a graduate student conference, and the topic was something like the future of the past. And obviously that was broad enough that I found it completely overwhelming. Mm. And so I didn't write the paper, you know. And so coming up to the time that I was supposed to go out there is when Michael Brown got shot. That was August the 9th of 2014, and the uprising began. And because I am from Missouri, and because of the way that I have for a long time tried to link my intellectual life to political engagement of various kinds, I felt like I couldn't go to Missouri and not talk about Michael Brown, not talk mm-hmm. about Ferguson, not talk about what was happening without getting too, smarmy about it. I felt called. And so I started at that point to look at the political economy of Ferguson, which is kind of following my turn of mind, the way that I think about violence and white supremacy in society is inseparable from political economy. They're one and the same thing. And the first thing I discovered really, just by looking at a map of Ferguson, really, was that there's a $26 billion a year corporation in the city limits of Ferguson, Emerson Electric. Mm. And so it seemed incredible to me. It seemed puzzling. It seemed brazenly obscene that the police department in Ferguson was farming poor black motorists in general, but particularly poor black motorists, for traffic tickets and issuing all these warrants, and people are getting put in jail in order to balance the city's books. And I thought, well, why isn't this corporation paying taxes? Why is this city in this kind of financial straits? And so that led me into an investigation of the politics of tax abatement and underassessment of real property in St. Louis County, and gradually into a little bit deeper analysis of the history of race, space, and real estate of white supremacy and wealth in the city of St. Louis over the course of the 20th century. And even at that point, I didn't settle on writing a book about St. Louis. I was, to some degree, I think, ambivalent about going back to Missouri, which is a place that I love and very much identify with. And yet there were reasons that I left and haven't gone back. I've been back to visit, but haven't gone back to live. Mm. And it took me a while to really, really settle in and decide to write a book about it. But at some point, as I thought more about it, and I thought about the imperial history of St. Louis, things that I had known about from my earlier work on the 19th century, the way that St. Louis functioned as the hub of the Western Department of the United States Army in the 19th century, it seemed to me like there was just too much there to ignore, too many stories that needed to be told, and also a chance to try to tell a story that was at once about the history of imperialism and anti-blackness.
Great. Yeah, that's actually anticipating what I was going to ask you next, which is that the book really begins with, and one of the key arguments of the book is that anti-blackness has everything to do with imperialism. So could you talk a bit more for our listeners about what you mean by that, and what is gained by having this kind of removalist, understanding of white supremacy, as well as having an understanding of white supremacy as predatory?
Yeah. So one of the things that I learned really in writing my second book was about the very, very deep connections between the history of the United States slavery and Indian removal and imperialism in the Deep South. And the fact that I can, it's not as if nobody had made that point before. Many people had. I had written an entire book, one book, which I'm very proud of, Soul by Soul, my first book, which didn't really engage that question forthrightly. And so I tried in my second book to do that. So I had tried in my second book, River of Dark Dreams, to do that. But when I started to look at the history of Missouri, I saw something different. Anti-blackness and the anti-blackness that is directly related to Indian removal in the Deep South, in the slaveholding South, the enslaving South, is pronatalist. It's very, very focused on the question of social reproduction. The social reproduction of the society depends upon the biological reproduction of the enslaved population. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I had worked on in the second book is a moment in the late 1850s when white people, slaveholders in the Deep South start to think about trying to reopen the Atlantic slave trade. And I had recognized that that was a way of trying to open up a pathway of commercial reproduction to replace the biological reproduction of enslaved people. All of that had made me very acutely attuned to the reproductive dynamic of racial capitalism and imperialism. And that stands in contrast, of course, to the exterminationist approach to Native Americans. So the slaveholding imperial project was at once exterminationist in relationship to Native Americans and pronatalist in relationship to African Americans. What I found in Missouri was different. And I found a social formation that was removalist and eventually exterminationist, or exterminationist from the beginning and removalist in relationship to Native Americans, but also found that from the very beginning and increasingly over the course of the 19th century, I think it was removalist and exterminationist in relationship to African Americans. And so as I thought more and more about it, it seemed to me like that was a Western as opposed to a Southern pattern of anti-blackness. Now, those are schematic categories. And there were slaveholders in Missouri, particularly in central Missouri, but also in St. Louis, who were very, very concerned about the reproduction of enslaved people. And so their anti-blackness reflected this other pattern. And certainly over the course of the 19th century, particularly after the Civil War, people in the South become more and more, white people in the South become more and more exterminationist, they removalist. They want to get rid of African Americans. But I felt like I saw something, and this is, based on the work, prior work, people, I'm not the first person to have worked on the history of St. Louis by any stretch. And I'm not really the first person to have made that connection. But as I worked, it became more and more a part of the way that I saw not just the history of the 19th century, but I saw the history of the city. And I think arguably the West, the American West, up through the 20th century.
Right. And it all in the book begins with the story of settler colonialism, which is much more than settler colonialism, as you show. I mean, I read it as you showing this push for deregulation from below all throughout the early 19th century. So we see these characters in the book. We see these white settlers who are hungry for land, and they're pushing the government to abandon Indian diplomacy and to open up land to be able to be acquired directly or more quickly. And we see, you know, white supremacist militias, which are preempting the U.S. Army's invasion of Native American land. We're seeing commercial interests which preempt the militarization of key economic corridors. So it's a lot of stuff happening that begins at the ground level and then pushes up. Could you talk a bit more about if that's how you were thinking about it as you wrote it? And how do we understand this transition of St. Louis from a fur trade hub to a settler empire hub?
That's fantastic, the way that you put it. And I think that's probably more clear. You put it more clearly than I managed to put it in the book, but you're exactly right. What I'm trying to do is to think fairly carefully about the relationship between the government, capitalist kind of commercial, mostly merchant actors, and white settlers and militia. And to not think of those different pieces as always unified, to think about them as murderous and white supremacist in different ways, in ways that sometimes come into conflict. And so, for instance, the United States Army is, in many instances in the 19th century, frustrated with the fact that white settlers and also commercial interests, particularly in the region I'm talking about, fur traders, are getting way out in front of the army, and they believe are drawing the army into conflicts. And that's, you know, that's not to say that they don't cooperate all the time, nor is it to say that when the army eventually does intervene, you know, I think in almost any given instance, they end up taking the part of the settlers. It's just to try to understand the complexity of the interests. And I think that as the century goes on, from the beginning of the 19th century up through the even through the 1890s, gradually the United States Army becomes more and more the leading edge of violence, replacing settlers. And gradually over the course of the century, I think it's probably possible to say that settler interests, in the sense of people who are going to go out and want to live on the land and have farms and families, I think that those interests are gradually replaced by corporate interests, by railroad interests. And so what you see by the end of the century is the railroad companies in the United States Army operating hand in hand. There's a set of changes. Now, one of the things that I think about a lot, and I'm not certain that I have a set of good answers to, is that even as these things change, and even as I'm interested in, and I think it's important to track those changes, the story looked at from the other side is a story of repetition, of the repetition of racial capitalist, white supremacist, removalist violence. And that persists, you know, from the 17th century on, but in the story that I'm really telling, from the beginning of the 19th century on. It's a story also, however, of continued and consequential resistance to that, whether we're talking about the Arikara in 1824, who really turned back an effort to proletarianize the Native Americans involved in the fur trade, or the way that, in fact, the Shoshones are able to really hold the line on the fur trade in the upper Mississippi for a long time, and to keep white fur traders from traveling further up. And so, you know, there's a set of stories that it's never a simple sort of settler colonial or imperial expansion. It's a war.
Hmm. I think the complexity of the story is precisely its strength, or at least as a reader, I really appreciated that you also carry that forward. So in coming chapters, in the next chapters on slavery and St. Louis, you show that there are in the city both pro and anti-slavery white factions. But within the anti-slavery camp, there are several different approaches on offer in the mid-19th century. So one is the imperialist approach, people who are free soilers who oppose slavery because it's cheapening white wages and because it's creating this landholding aristocracy that they're not a part of. And then the response that's coming from these people is to limit the entry of free Black people into St. Louis, or just remove them from the United States if possible, and to compensate for any loss that comes from abolition by annexing more and more native land and moving further and further west. And then on the other hand, there's also an anti-slavery faction, probably much smaller, that is opposing slavery as it opposes all forms of private property. So tell us a bit more about this conflict as it played out in St. Louis before and during the Civil War.
Yeah, I think of that as basically a conflict between a sort of a white supremacist anti-slavery liberalism and a anti-slavery radicalism that is at its very best able to imagine a set of political alliances between Black and white. And I think that one of the stories that I'm trying to tell is the way that that alliance, that liberal radical alliance, could hold together through the period of the Civil War. And it could hold together because they are both in one way anti-slavery. But beneath that is a real instability around the question of property and around the question of even the bare presence of African Americans in the West. And I think the center of gravity in Missouri, as elsewhere in the West, and I think in the United States, is with a kind of white supremacist anti-slavery free soilism, with the idea that, and which is an imperialist center of gravity, with the idea that the West is going to be a place for white workers and white farmers to fulfill their sort of patriarchal potential in householding, you know, freedom, that kind of Republican ideal that I started looking at so long ago. And I think that one of the things that I think of as an important argument that I make in the book is to try to look at, really from the, to try to look at Abraham Lincoln and the Union Army from the standpoint of St. Louis. And so immediately what you see, this is, I guess, a point of the moment, is that many of the people who are the heroes of the Union Army war effort were Indian killers. They had begun their careers, many of them in California, in a set of wars up and down California in the 1840s and 50s that are, I think, quite clearly genocidal. Mm-hmm. And so that leaves us with a dilemma that's kind of cutting through our society right now. I mean, there's all the Confederate monuments are coming down and being contested. But at the very edge of that, there's also a reckoning with imperialist monuments, with Columbus most obviously. But of course, we haven't quite yet got to the fact that so many of these Union soldiers were Indian killers. So that's one part of it. And then one part of it's more directly about what I see as an effort to hold the coalition that was the Union Army supporting coalition together by balancing every step towards the emancipation of enslaved people with imperialism, with the Homestead Act, with the Transcontinental Railroad, or with the land grant universities. And so to effectively imperially seize from Native Americans the West and to distribute it to the white population of the United States in various forms as a way to, you know, sort of to compensate white people for the emancipation of African Americans.
Right. And that's a kind of racial capitalism that's not, you know, that we don't, I guess, think about as much as we should. It's not some effort to divide a unified working class by doing these things. These things are actually the economically logical things to be doing.
Yeah, I think that one of the way, I mean, I wanted to try over the course of the book and over the course of my teaching and other things that I'm writing to think about racial capitalism as multiform and variable and changing over time. And certainly one of the things that you see is an effort on the part of elites to compensate or to co-opt or to include, to share the spoils of empire with working white people, working and poor white people. And that's really, to me, for instance, the story of Thomas Hart Benton, who is, you know, he's a kind of a, in a way, he's a corporate lapdog for the wealthiest fur trading interests and commercial interests in the state of Missouri. But at the same time, he's a real seen as a kind of a populist champion of the common man who wants to distribute the West to poor white people on very, very favorable terms. And so, you know, figures like that are interesting to me and people who I'm trying to make sense of.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So throughout the book, you rely a lot on the Black radical tradition. You rely a lot on Du Bois. And your book has actually been called one of the best Du Boisian histories of America. So one of the places that this comes through most explicitly for a reader is where you discuss the counter-revolution of property that followed the 1877 strike in St. Louis. So could you tell us what was the strike and then what is a counter-revolution of property? What did it look like?
Yeah, so one of the things I didn't speak about as clearly as I should have before when we were talking about the Civil War is who these radicals are. And many of them are refugees from the European revolutions of 1848. And some of them are communists, and at least one of them is quite famous in the intellectual history of Marxism. And that's Joseph Weydemeyer, who was a companion, an intellectual companion of Marx and Engels, and was, I think, the publisher, the first publisher of the 18th Brumaire and the translator of the German ideology. And so Weydemeyer turns up in St. Louis at some point right before the Civil War and becomes, he joins the United States Army. He's a colonel, and he is actually the person who designed the artillery defense of the city during the Civil War. And he is part of a circle of communists who are around John C. Fremont, who is a fascinating and rebarbative, disgusting figure, both an Indian killer, but also the person who issued the first general emancipation order in the United States in August of 1861, which was issued in St. Louis, and immediately countermanded by Lincoln. And Fremont did this under the influence of these communists, Weydemeyer and Franz Ziegel is another important one, who really convinced him that the war, in order to be won, the war had to be a war against property as well as a war for union. It had to be a war against slavery as well as a war to preserve the union in 1861. So there is that radical tradition in St. Louis, and I think that it follows through. And, you know, there are various ways you could pick it up in the years between the end of the Civil War and 1877, but it explodes in St. Louis in 1877, which was a year that there were railroad strikes all across the United States. But in St. Louis, that railroad strike grew into a general strike. And by the end of the general strike, there was a people's committee that was making decisions about which factories would be allowed to reopen on what terms and which trains could come in and out of the cities. There was, you could argue, a dictatorship of the proletariat, which is a phrase that many think originated with Joseph Weidemann. That general strike was crushed, and it was crushed by a combination of vigilantes armed by the ruling class of the city and state militia and federal troops coming in reserve, fresh from fighting wars against Native Americans. And I argue following Du Bois, and particularly following the work of Manu Kuruka, that what happened after that was a kind of a counter-revolution. And it was the emergence, the reassertion of power by the commercial, the capitalist ruling class in St. Louis. And it was basically a doubling down on empire. So they began more and more to draw more and more wealth from the West. And so what I'm trying to argue there is that the resolution, the final resolution of the Civil War in St. Louis was in a imperial expansion into the West. And I'm trying there to, I think, draw a new resonance onto the question of reunion after the Civil War. And so it's been long understood that reunion after the Civil War involved the reunion between North and South. I'm talking about the reunion of white elites, involved the selling out of the African Americans in the South. Involved the removal in 1877 of the United States troops that were occupying the South. And incidentally, or not incidentally really, that was a political program that really emerged out of Missouri in the 1870s, liberal republicanism. What I think has been less fully present in that set of arguments that historians, I think, probably by and large agree on, is that the site of the reunion was by and large in the West, and it was with the United States economic expansion, imperial economic expansion through the Transcontinental Railroad, the Indian Wars of the 1870s and 80s, and imperial expansion, economic expansion into Mexico, and then gradually to the Pacific. So I'm trying to think about all of that imperialism as, in effect, the material ground of the Civil War settlement.
And I think that also carries through in the way you look at and understand the world wars of the 20th century. So you recount in the book that 1917 East St. Louis Massacre was one of the deadliest massacres against African American people at the time, and you center in that story not just attitudinal racism, but also the many misdiagnoses that the city's labor movement at the time made, specifically when they went on a strike and saw the failure of their strike as the fault of Black workers rather than of their employer or of their own exclusion of Black workers. And this is a fault line that we know appears in the labor movement again and again. How do you account for that? And what can we learn, about this wartime labor mobilization that happened and what it turned into?
Yeah, I think that Du Bois has an essay about the massacre in East St. Louis called Of Work and Wealth. And one of the things that he says in that essay, I believe it's in that essay, is that among the greatest failures of the organized labor in the United States by 1917 was the failure to recognize 4 million emancipated African Americans as labor. And so you have a situation in East St. Louis, which is unionized under the auspices of the AFL, where the locals are all segregated. And so the national AFL is officially open to African-American workers, but it's really up to the locals whether or not African-Americans will be included. And all the locals in East St. Louis were segregated at a time when African-Americans were increasingly leaving the South, coming north on railroad trains, particularly the Illinois Central, which runs right up from New Orleans through Mississippi to St. Louis and then you know, on to Chicago. And so you have a massive migration of African-Americans looking for better lives and fairer employment coming north. And at the same time, you have a kind of a white supremacist retrenchment of the notion of, you know, these are white cities and white jobs. And all of that explodes over the course of the summer of 1917 in East St. Louis, particularly around a strike at the aluminum ore factory, which was the largest aluminum processing plant in the United States. And the bosses bring in African-American workers. Those workers are, after a time, protected by the Illinois State Militia. And that sets off a kind of a anaphylactic response among the white working class, who I think understand themselves as the true Americans and all of a sudden are being painted as unpatriotic for being on strike during wartime. And it explodes in a kind of a removalist paroxysm. I think the thing that I have in the book to add to that story is a focus on really following Ida B. Wells in this chapter rather than Du Bois, because Ida B. Wells comes to East St. Louis, you know, literally while the place is still smoking, 2 days after the massacre. She comes and gets off the train. And I mean, it's impossible, I think, to fathom her courage. You know, a black woman walking alone from the train depot, she had to walk across a creek that was probably still choked with bodies. And walking to the town hall where people had taken refuge, and then going out with black women to look at their looted, burned, and destroyed houses. And really, it's through Wells writing about the massacre that I came to understand it as a fight about labor and the plants, but also as an effort at black removal, as an attack on the black future in East St. Louis, as an attack on black women and children. And so to then, and it was really, I think, probably as I started to see the massacre that way, that I started to understand that the history of removal that I had been tracking in the 19th century carried forward into the 20th.
And the story gets pretty dire even after that. So you talk about there's a resurgence of labor radicalism in the 1930s, which is actually interracial to some extent, and gains a lot, but then becomes suppressed by yet another counter-revolution carried out by the U.S. government, corporations, and white unions. And this time, they build the removalism into the material infrastructures of the city, of everyday life. So what does this look like? And what are some of the key features, you know, of the counter-revolution that happens after the 30s?
Yes. So I think the thing that you start with is to me, one of the things that I had not expected when I started working on 20th century St. Louis is a history of really, really vanguard radicalism. And so one of the moments in that is the strike at Funston Nut Factory, which was the largest employer of African-American women in the city, employed about 2,500 African-American women. And this was a strike that was largely organized by African-American women in tandem with and with the support of the Communist Party, which was very strong in St. Louis in the 1930s, as it was in other parts of the United States. And they, I think it was a 9-day strike, and they won in the teeth of the beginning of the Depression, right? I mean, this was, I think it was 1932 or 1933. I can't remember right now. And I followed that up with, you know, a set of other strikes in the 1930s. One of them, famously and importantly, at Emerson Electric, the company with which my, you know, intellectual journey to St. Louis began, was, I think, maybe the second longest sit-down strike in the history of the United States at that point. I think that was 1936 or 37. And these are interracial strikes in every case. And you have black and white people striking together, going to jail together. And so there is something that is very powerful and very threatening happening in St. Louis. I think that the Second World War takes some of the wind out of the sails of that. I think that partly because the working class in St. Louis is transformed by a lot of in-migration from rural whites from Missouri who are coming into defense industry, who are not organized in the way that the working class was before, not radicalized. And I think there is a kind of a counter-revolutionary attack that takes the form of something that I think the alliance, the communists, that nobody in St. Louis was prepared to resist, because it took the form of real estate capitalism. And so I think that the unions and the communists in particular, but also the black middle class organizations like the Urban League, had focused a lot of their energy and quite rightly on the question of employment. But what they had to some degree not seen coming was a new economic formation that was going to be as focused on expropriation as it was on different forms of exploitation. And so the racial division of the labor market, which we saw in East St. Louis, is still present and it's still a problem. But what you see is interest coming in and just tearing down neighborhoods, tearing down, you know, hundreds of acres at a time, and along the riverfront in St. Louis, where the arch is today, and then in a neighborhood called Mill Creek Valley, which was really the heart of working class Black St. Louis, where they tore down. It was a gradual process. Mill Creek Valley wasn't torn down until 1959. The riverfront was torn down in 1930. And so what's happening is, number one, the value of surviving property in the city is being increased. And this is quite clearly an explicit purpose of the teardowns, because the overall number of square feet in the city is being diminished, right? And so real estate holders are being both compensated for property if it's being torn down, and are being rewarded by being able to charge higher rents in surviving property. I think after the Second World War, and this would be the case for Mill Creek Valley, there's also a very explicit emphasis on the employment of white men returning from service. And so there's an effort to create jobs. And I think that effort fuels the interstate highways, which are driven through black neighborhoods in St. Louis, and it fuels the mania for destroying Mill Creek Valley, which is, you know, as I said, almost 500 acres, populated by 20,000 people, 800 business or cultural institutions, and when they finish, I think there's maybe six buildings left, and everybody's been pushed out into the city. There's a working assumption that everyone, you know, that all these displaced people will land in the Pruitt-Igoe housing project, which is being constructed, had been constructed by 1959. I think it was opened in 1954, but there's no real mechanism to set up to help people relocate. There's no sort of institutional infrastructure for helping people. And indeed, calls from African Americans and progressive whites to set that up, they fall on deaf ears.
And then this is where you come back to where we began talking about, what we began talking about at the beginning of the podcast, where you talk about the structural racism that, you know, undergirds the Ferguson uprising of 2014. And you mention in the book that the term gets thrown around a lot, but it's too often used to just vaguely gesture at really bad racism or really persistent racism. And in the last chapter of the book, you explain what we should mean by it instead. So could you go into that for our listeners about, yeah.
Yeah, really what I'm trying to talk about, I think, is the way that programs which may begin as explicitly racist are structured into the fabric, or may not in the beginning be justified as explicitly racist, but nevertheless have very disparate racial effects, become the common sense of our daily lives because they're built into the landscape. And that would, you know, an obvious example would be where the interstates are laid out, mm-hmm. and who's employed in building the interstates. And then the way that they effectively serve suburban interests by allowing suburbanites to commute in and out of cities in order to work, even as they function in a city like St. Louis as bypass routes, as ways to speed, you know, through or across devastated Black neighborhoods on the way downtown or the way across the country. And I think that's true of the United States in general. I mean, why do we need a six-lane highway between Boston and rural Maine? Well, that's to serve vacationing Bostonians as mm-hmm. they drive north. Or, you know, and you could, you know, if you think about whatever cities you have been in or lived in, you can extend the list. And so beginning with that, then I tried over the course of the book to track the successive displacements of the African-American population of St. Louis. And again, this is schematic rather than exhaustive, but you could argue that there's a kind of an arc of displacement that runs from East St. Louis to Mill Creek Valley to the Pruitt-Igoe housing project, which was blown up in 1972, to North County, where Ferguson is. And so there's a serial kind of displacement of this population. As it's in every single case, there's a different kind of money to be made off of the control or removal of the population. And so it's not as if it's just racism that's displacing the population. It's a succession of kind of racial capitalist forms of exploitation and increasingly just expropriation. And what I argue characterizes our moment is it's a moment where, because of the deindustrialization of the cities in favor of the suburbs and exurbs, but really the deindustrialization of the United States of America and global outsourcing, the Black population of the city of St. Louis has become increasingly inert from the standpoint of production. You know, there are just no jobs for people, and there's no real way to exploit them for labor. But what's happened then is a set of exactions or extractions, whether that's payday loans, which I try to talk about, or it's for-profit policing of the kind that happened in Ferguson, or it's the economy of tax abatements, which I try to talk about in fairly great detail, where the presence of poor African Americans is used to justify tax breaks for wealthy corporations, which build, you know, tax-free buildings, thus robbing those very disadvantaged populations of any funding for the schools, because real estate taxes are school funding in the United States is generally tied to real estate taxes. So all over city, you know, St. Louis is, I think, the first or second most tax abated city in the United States. And all of those are justified by the presence of, quote, urban blight, which is a euphemism for Black people. And then finally, the economy of mass incarceration. And so I see the final way in which just the basic presence of an African-American population is used to support businesses and programs that are advantageous to white people in mass incarceration, and the way that the state of Missouri has located, I can't remember what it is, but maybe it's 18 of 22 penal institutions in the state of Missouri are located in predominantly white rural areas. And so there's a constant flow then of African Americans, many of whom have been, you know, incarcerated for the sorts of bullshit offenses that we see all over the nation, particularly around drugs, but also small property crimes, and are then, you know, become in effect a subsidy to white construction workers, white prison guards, white caterers, et cetera, in rural Missouri.
Right. So you end the book by talking about the fact that there are a lot of Black organizers in St. Louis who are working towards changing things. And we've obviously seen that now happening nationwide. So what are reasons to hope, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I think as I've tried to think about the book more with a little bit of distance, I think probably the argument is that the history of St. Louis has frequently influenced but often prefigured the history of the United States. And I see a lot of prefiguration in what has happened in St. Louis over the last 3 or 4 years that I've been, you know, really finishing. There was an uprising in St. Louis in the fall of 2017 around the acquittal of a particularly murdering police officer. And that was the response on the part of the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department, St. Louis, Missouri Police Department, was it was a police riot. It was a month-long police riot in St. Louis, very much like what we've just seen in the United States in general. And so in the aftermath of that, and I think that this is, I hope it's in a way, is prefigurative, there have been some small successes, noteworthy successes, the election of Kim Gardner as the circuit prosecutor, the circuit attorney in St. Louis, and Wesley Bell in the county. So the displacement of at least the old white supremacist aligned prosecutor's office. And they have somewhat amazingly, I think, after 2 years of organizing just yesterday or the day before, managed to finally close the medium security prison in St. Louis called the Workhouse, which is a place that a lot of people were held, you know, poor people who couldn't pay bail were being held in the Workhouse, which was this, you know, just horrible setting with, you know, it's either too hot in the summer. I mean, a couple of summers ago, there was a real crisis around, it was like 120 degrees and, you know, 80-90% humidity in the Workhouse. And so then they brought in these huge industrial air conditioning units, and then all of a sudden it was, you know, 55-60 degrees in there, everybody was freezing. Just so it's a torturous environment. And just 2 days ago, after a huge organizational effort on the part of African-American organizers in St. Louis, that was abolished. And I think that what we just saw this week with Expect Us marching through the private neighborhood on Portland Place, and then these, you know, these kooky McCloskeys coming out of their house with guns and waving the guns around. I mean, I think in that way, the city of St. Louis prefigures both the radical possibilities of this moment, because I think Expect Us was making a point not simply about Black Lives Matter in the abstract or about statues, but they're making a point about the way that the history of race and empire is embedded in the history of St. Louis by violating that neighborhood. And like all the best, nonviolent civil disobedience, what they managed to do was to trigger an overreaction and to make something apparent about the society. And what I think they made apparent about the society was they revealed anew the connection between property and white violence in the history of the United States. And so I really think that we still have a lot to learn from what people are doing in St. Louis. The things that I focus on in the epilogue are things that I think about as people just kind of getting on with it and building a different kind of city within the interstices of racial capitalism and police violence. And I think I finally found a word for that in abolition or in what Ruth Gilmore says, that, you know, there are people who are building fragments of a future. They're building different forms of ways of being in right relation to nature and to one another that kind of exemplify for us a better path forward and ways that to me are inspiring. And I say inspiring, in kind of a deep humility, because there are people who are living in a sort of a spirit of courage and generosity and humility that I haven't attained in my own life. And so I really do think that we have a lot to learn from just watching these people and how they're rebuilding the city sort of within and against itself.
So, Given everything that's been happening, what are you working on now and what's going to be next for you? Are you going to stay in Missouri?
Right now, I have just, having finished a season of homeschooling, I am, my seven-year-old is now, fully entertained by a little bit too much Pokemon Go. I'm trying to get started on a book about John Brown. So I want to write a book about the anti-slavery revolutionary John Brown, and to try to reckon with, to try to think together the politics of empire, right? So John Brown fights a war in Kansas against slavery. But that war is in Kansas, which is to say that war is a war that is also being staged on Indian ground. So I want to think about that. And I want to try to think about the different influences on John Brown, who was very, very cognizant of the Black radical tradition, who had read about the Haitian Revolution, who had read about the Maroons in Jamaica and Suriname, but was also in conversation with the very sort of white supremacist opponents of slavery who we were talking about a little bit earlier, specifically Hinton Rowan Helper, who's somebody I wrote about in my second book, and sort of to try and think about how those different kinds of commitments shaped his endeavors in Kansas and at Harper's Ferry. And I want to think about the role of revolutionary violence. I wanted to meditate, and I don't yet have an answer for this, but I want to think very hard about John Brown going out in the middle of the night in Kansas and pulling pro-slavery militiamen out of their houses in the middle of the night and cutting their heads off. And to try to reckon forthrightly with the political and moral implications of that.
Well, just like this book, it seems like that book is going to be, or that project is going to be, a very timely one, no matter when it's completed.
Yeah, I was going to say, I wish I could say that I'll talk to you soon about it. But.
Well, I'll definitely keep an eye out for it and follow up with you. But thank you so much for this amazing book and for talking to our listeners.
Thank you for those amazing questions. I feel like they made the book better even as we were talking about it, so I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right.